It's Friday, April 5th. No one puts BB in a corner until now. We start here. The Biden White House tells Israel we've had it.
We are willing to reconsider our own policy approaches here.
This is as close as you get to a straight-up diplomatic threat. Special Counsel Jack Smith stares down the judge in the Trump documents case.
Judge Cam just kind of backed off.
We'll explain why this entire trial now hangs in the balance. And how did a crew of criminals walk away with $30 million in cash?
They had to have the right gear to get in through the roof, to go undetected, to not set off the alarms.
The bizarre case unfolding in Los Angeles, far away from any bank vaults. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When you look back at early October, in the wake of the worst terror attack in Israeli history, it was clear how much President Joe Biden wanted to support Israel. Like, that was clearly his instinct.
We will continue to have Israel's back as you work to defend your people.
He immediately stood square in Israel's corner, and yet, as the civilian deaths skyrocketed, as Israeli troops made it virtually impossible for Gazans to feed themselves, and as American calls for basic humanitarian allowances went unheeded, you could see Biden slowly but surely backing away.
The leadership of Israel, I say this, humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority.
The last couple of months have exposed how little trust the Biden White House now has for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And when an Israeli airstrike killed 7 aid workers this week, it finally put what was once a steadfast alliance on the shakiest ground we've seen in decades. Well, yesterday, Biden and Netanyahu appeared to speak for the first time since this strike, and to some, this seemed less like a reconciliation, more like an ultimatum. ABC Chief White House Correspondent Mary Bruce is with us. Mary, do we know what was said in this meeting? What happened here?
Well, we actually have a pretty good sense of what was said in this tense, roughly 30-minute conversation. It has been described to us as being very direct, very businesslike, very professional on both sides. That's a lot of buzzwords there. Make no mistake, there was a real shift in tone here from President Biden, a shift in tone in potential policy from this White House. President Biden bluntly told Prime Minister Netanyahu that he has to take concrete steps to address civilian harm and humanitarian suffering or risk the U.S. changing course.
We are willing to reconsider our own policy approaches here, dependent upon what the Israelis do or don't do.
This is really the first time that we are seeing the U.S. and this president essentially trying to leverage U.S. support to influence Israel's conduct in this war, Brad.
That sounds, are we talking about threats now? Sort of policy-wise, these are threats from the U.S. towards Israel?
Yeah, I mean, look, the White House has made very clear if there are not changes to Israel's approach to this, it is very likely that the U.S. is going to change our approach.
Characterize this call as an ultimatum.
I would characterize this call as very direct.
And in the briefing here yesterday, there were a lot of questions about what this looks like, as you can imagine, especially what exactly is the U.S. looking for?
There are things that need to be done. There are too many civilians being killed. The risk to aid workers is unacceptable. Now we have certain aid organizations that are reconsidering whether they're even going to be able to continue operations in Gaza while famine looms.
The White House spokesman John Kirby made it clear that they want to see a dramatic increase in humanitarian assistance, opening up additional crossings, and overall a reduction in the violence against civilians and certainly against aid workers. That is what they are looking for Netanyahu to do. The question is, what happens if he doesn't?
Yeah, I want that answer. What happens if he doesn't? Because it's tough to ignore the fact, Mary, that just this week, the same week that our government is saying they're very upset about this, our government's also sending weapons to Israel. So, I mean, is that on the menu? What could change?
Yeah, it's a good point. Look, despite the president's ramped up rhetoric, increasing frustration and outrage, despite his strong condemnation, the president has resisted calls to limit or condition U.S. military assistance to Israel. And as you noted, the administration just this week approved the delivery of thousands of more bombs. That was part of a previous agreement.
Is the president threatening to withhold aid to Israel if they do not make these changes?
But I pressed the White House on this directly. I mean, what happens if Israel doesn't meet President Biden's demands? Is the president threatening to withhold aid to Israel if they don't make these changes? Not surprisingly, the White House isn't going into detail just yet.
The president made it clear that our policies with respect to Gaza will be dependent upon our assessment of how well the Israelis make changes and implement changes to make the situation in Gaza better for the Palestinian people.
And the White House says they are hoping and expecting to see some kind of announcements or changes here in the coming hours and days. They are really ramping up the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu.
Wow. I mean, these are sort of the dust-ups you'd imagine with the U.S. and some sort of adversarial countries. You hear that language, but never, never with Israel. All right. Mary Bruce, covering the White House. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, it's a game of chicken with the former president's freedom on the line. The new twist in the Trump documents case after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. When it comes to the criminal cases against former President Donald Trump, he often invokes a pretty simple, if unlikely, legal argument that a former president can't be prosecuted for anything he ever did in office.
Presidents have to be given total immunity. They have to be allowed to do their job.
This has been shot down by judges at several levels, but remember, there is one federal case that has to do only with the stuff he did after he left the White House.
Federal prosecutors are in possession of an audio recording where former President Trump appears to acknowledge having classified documents.
Yeah. See, as president, I could have declassified. Yeah. Now I can't, you know, but this is classified.
Yeah, now we have a problem.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Trump has pleaded not guilty to 37 counts related to classified documents found at his Mar-a-Lago estate well after he left office. Remember, the government tried for months to get these documents back and finally resorted to raiding his home.
The indictment describes the documents spread out in boxes across Mar-a-Lago, in a bathroom, a ballroom, a shower.
We did absolutely nothing wrong. Take a look at the Presidential Records Act. We did it by the book. Perfect.
For all these reasons, this case has the potential to be perhaps the most straightforward of them all. And yet, for the last few weeks, this really bizarre back and forth has been happening between Special Prosecutor Jack Smith and the judge. Judge Eileen Cannon seemed to be signaling that perhaps Trump was allowed to hold on to whatever documents he wanted to, simply because he was once the president. Well, yesterday, this judge made a surprising new ruling, and ABC's Alex Mallon is here to help us sort it all out. Alex, before we even talk about this ruling yesterday, can you just back up and explain the legal back and forth here?
Yeah, Brad. So basically, former President Trump's attorneys started to introduce this idea that Trump should be immune from prosecution in this case because of the idea that under the Presidential Records Act, this act that basically governs once presidents leave the White House, how they hand over records to the National Archives, that under that, Trump actually should have been protected from prosecution over these classified documents that he brought home to his Mar-a-Lago estate, because by bringing them home, he had designated them as his personal effects. Now, Special Counsel Smith has obviously said that this is an absurd argument. And also, they say that this is one that he only adopted long after he was found to be in possession of records that he should not have had once they began their criminal investigation into him. So we get to this point where now Judge Cannon is hearing arguments on Trump's motions to dismiss about a month ago in a hearing. And she actually did seem to accept the idea that there was no way that she would be able to dismiss the case on those grounds. Now, move forward 2 weeks later, and she issues this really unusual order where she basically says, I want both parties in this case to present me with hypothetical jury instructions that were really sympathetic, strangely, to this idea that Trump may have had a case here that he did designate these highly classified records as his personal effects. It really perplexed a lot of legal experts who had been looking at those arguments where she seemed to dismiss this argument.
Because this is what, like, where people start going, oh, she almost, it almost seems like the judge here wants to dismiss this. Like, that was the tea leaves that a lot of people were reading here, that she was sympathetic to Trump.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is a Trump-appointed judge, and she has in many cases throughout the entirety of this case, you know, issued strangely favorable rulings, giving Trump's team, you know, extended time. And we also note that she has not set a new trial date in the case. She's supposed to, this case was actually supposed to go to trial in May, and she has asked the parties for alternate trial dates, but she still has yet over a month later not set another trial date. And so basically, the special counsel, I think, had reached this boiling point after getting these proposed jury instructions from her that really was overly sympathetic in their mind to this really what they view as an outlandish argument from Trump's team. So what we saw from Jack Smith earlier this week was an extraordinary filing where they took Cannon to task in a way that they have not done in this case before. They pointed out that if she continues to hold this position, they would seek review or appeal her before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And reminder, Brad, that they have actually done this twice before successfully, back before Trump was even indicted, when Cannon appointed a special master to review all the materials that the FBI had seized from Mar-a-Lago. And they used the exact same argument to overturn her then. She was, again, during that same period, sympathetic to this idea that, you know, what if he had designated some of these effects as personal? That should be reviewed by the special master. And they are essentially, in this argument, taking back to her the fact that she was already overturned by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and they will use that same opinion to overturn her again if necessary, if she does not change course.
Okay, wow. Okay, so Jack Smith's people think this judge seems to, like, be on Trump's side from everything they've seen. Then the judge says, hey, I want you to give me, like, sample jury instructions. And it sounds like Jack Smith's people are like, oh, she's looking for a reason to be like, these jury instructions are bad. I'm actually going to toss this whole case. Like, they think that the judge is almost looking for a reason to make life easier on Trump. They come back and say, we're going to challenge your logic, your judicial logic. What happened yesterday?
So yesterday, Brad, Judge Cannon just kind of backed off. Cannon issues this order finally that does reject Trump's efforts to try and throw out the case based on the PRA. But again, Brett, in this order, she rebukes Special Counsel Smith for his filing earlier this week and essentially says that their demand to her to try and state her position over whether the PRA is going to play any role in jury instructions, she calls that demand unprecedented and unjust. And she says that she's not going to do that. She says at this stage in the litigation, it's not appropriate for her to take a position either way. But she also says that if the special counsel wants to appeal her up to the 11th Circuit, they're more than welcome to do so. And now we're at a true impasse, Brad, because once this gets into the jury instruction lane, that becomes unappealable for Jack Smith. So I think he's now presented with this decision where, while at the same time, Judge Cannon seems to be temporarily backing off of this idea that Trump had any claim of personal ownership of these documents, she's also saying that, you know, down the road, this will potentially come up as an issue again. And is that sustainable for Jack Smith? Is this something where he believes he could have success going to the appeals court in advance to try and basically have them order her not to bring this issue up again in advance of trial? Again, very, very high bars for all of this, for them to have any success in doing so, because it's just very rare for an appeals court to really step in at this stage of a trial or of a case and overrule a judge while they're trying to get this towards trial.
Right, which is why you had legal analysts saying yesterday, Judge Cannon seemed to back off here, but it also ensures that this case continues on with her on the bench. Alex Mallon, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
I often find myself thinking of Los Angeles as like the bank robbery capital of the world. You know, I'm thinking about movies like Point Break. I'm thinking of Heat.
Stay down. We want to hurt no one. We're here for the bank's money, not your money.
And the setting makes sense because this is a huge sprawling place with tons of banks, a ton of freeways to speed away on. In fact, forget movies. In real life, we have seen some of this country's most daring getaways and some of the deadliest police shootouts stemming from holdups. Well, yesterday we learned a group of criminals in LA was able to walk away recently with $30 million without a shot fired, and it wasn't even from a proper bank. ABC's Alex Stone is based in Los Angeles. Alex, this is $30 million in cash? Like, where do you even get that much money?
This is the thing, Brad. It is incredible to find out that this went down. Nobody knew about it for 12, 24 hours after it happened on Easter Sunday. That it was so quiet what happened and so well planned, it seems, that they were able to go in completely undetected, take upwards of $30 million and leave, and nobody knew it. This is at a facility owned by a worldwide company called Garda, which is a money handling company. You see their armored cars all over the road. They advertise vault services that they say they will safely and securely store a company's cash, that they will count it, that they will do all the accounting of it, that they hold on to money, they hold on to precious metals in their vaults. This is a nondescript building in the Sylmar area of LA where the armored cars come at the end of the night and they unload what they've got, what they're not bringing somewhere else, that it goes into their vault and then it is believed to be securely in that room. Well, on Easter Sunday, this group, the LAPD and the FBI, say that they got in through the roof of this building and they were able to bypass the alarm system. I mean, all of this is like something out of a movie. They bypass the alarm system, never set it off, go into the vault in a way that from the outside, you wouldn't even know anybody had been in there. And they were able to load up on all of that cash. And can you imagine how much weight $30 million in cash, what that would be like? I mean, we're talking hundreds of pounds that they had to figure out some way to get that out of the building and then be able to haul it away without anybody noticing. Nobody did. It was a perfect day on Easter Sunday. Nobody was around and they got away. And until Monday morning, when the Garda employees came in and went into the vault and said, "We got a problem here," nobody knew.
And police say that there was like a hole found in the side of this facility. Is that these guys, like, did they blow their way in with explosives or something?
So there are questions right now of what that hole is. And we don't totally know what that is. Did they blow their way out is the way it's kind of looking right now. When they were done, say we're out of here and go that way. Or is something else going on? The issue here is Garda is not responding to any media questions. They're not explaining anything. And we know that the FBI is now taking over this case. It's being seen kind of like a bank robbery. And as you mentioned, LA has a history of this. I mean, 2 years ago, there was a big rig north of LA that had maybe $100 million in jewels in it. Similar thing where there was a worker who was sleeping in the cab at a rest stop. Another worker was going to the restroom or getting a cup of coffee. They didn't even notice that they got burglarized and everything was gone. And they have never found those people. They don't think that this is related to that. But, you know, here in L.A., not just in the movies, it's flashy the way these things go down. And these are big dollar numbers.
Well, and it makes me wonder, like, you just mentioned these examples, and none of them are at what you'd call a classic bank, right? It doesn't seem like the MO is to go in through the vault of the big brand name bank. Instead, it's these more vulnerable points, or in this case, like sort of a private company.
Well, it seems like these are probably bigger numbers, right? You go into a bank, how much money are you going to get? You're probably not going to get $30 million if you walk into, you know, the general bank that's on the street corner. These people had to know what was in this building, just like in that big rig heist 2 years ago. They had to know that was an unmarked 18-wheeler. They had to know what was in the back of there. We are being told by law enforcement, at least this one, we don't know about the one 2 years ago, but this one, had to have been a crew. They had to have the right gear to get in through the roof, to go undetected, to not set off the alarms.
Sure.
They had to really either do a lot of homework or have somebody on the inside who knew something. The FBI and the LAPD, they think they are sophisticated, but who is behind it, they don't yet know.
Yeah, any other word on what this investigation starts to look like?
Well, the FBI is taking it over. Initially, it was the LAPD who went in and took the reports and said, wow, this really is a burglary. Now the FBI, almost like a bank robbery investigation, they're going to begin piecing this together. They've got to figure out something this sophisticated and this big, it could be global. To have a group that could pull something, you know, Ocean's 11 like this off without anybody knowing for quite a while, that shows you that they've got a lot of sophistication. And our sources are telling us they have no suspects. They have no idea who did this, but they're beginning to piece it together right now.
All right, Alex Stone there in L.A. Crazy story. Thank you so much.
You got it. Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, you thought that case was fishy? Well, this one will really keep you hooked. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. Salmon are some of the world's most resilient creatures, but even for them, this is overboard. This week, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife revealed that a truck carrying 100,000 Chinook salmon crashed on the side of the road. The driver's okay, some of the salmon did die, but this truck happened to crash next to a creek. The vast majority of the fish happened to flop into the water. Which is good news, right? For most of them, things are going swimmingly. Well, keep in mind, these salmon were actually on their way from a hatchery to a different river more than 50 miles away. These salmon effectively ended up being dumped into the wrong river. This matters for a couple reasons. One is because the Imnaha River, where they were supposed to be dropped off, is part of an Indian reservation that for years has had its waters diverted by federally built dams. So as part of this deal with local tribes, the U.S. government agreed to always repopulate their waters with salmon. These ones will now be missing. The other part of this is, remember, salmon migrate. They go out into the ocean, but then they always remember the river where they spent their juvenile lives. Later on, they make these epic journeys, sometimes hundreds of miles, to lay their eggs.
So they're traveling several thousand kilometers in their lives, and then they come back. And so it's a massive migration.
So when they're exactly this age, when they're known as smolts, it matters where you deposit them. So now locals are wondering, are we about to have 70,000 salmon coming back to this random creek a couple years from now? After all, these fish, Chinook salmon, are also known as king salmon. They can grow to be 30 to 100 pounds each. That's a lot of fish. Wildlife officials don't think it will be that dramatic. Next breeding season, they expect hundreds of extra eggs in this random tributary and thousands fewer in the Imnaha River. But they say they do plan to increase their shipments to tribal waters and keep an eye on this new breeding ground for years to come. Think about, though, any other trucking route that's not just next to a river and all these fish are gone. So fantastic coincidence. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas Baker, Vika Aronson, Cameron Chertavian, Anthony Ali, Mara Milwaukee, and Amira Williams. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of podcast programming. I'm our managing editor. Laura Mayer is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Tara Gimbel, and Liz Alessi. Special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Aaron Ferrer, Jonah Haskell, and Edward Sakaris. I'm Brad Milkey. See you next week.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.